Hopefully, technology allowing, we have a little video to open the talk today. You'll know it.
Why have you come back?
Please, sir, we've done what you told us. We brought you the broomstick of the Wicked Witch of the West. We melted her.
Ah, you liquidated her, eh? Very resourceful.
Yes, sir. So we'd like you to keep your promise to us, if you please, sir.
Not so fast. Not so fast. I'll have to give the matter a little thought. Go away and come back tomorrow.
Tomorrow? Oh, but I want to go home now.
You've had plenty of time already.
Yeah. Do not arouse the wrath of the great and powerful Oz. I said come back tomorrow.
If you are really great and powerful, you'd keep your promises.
Do you presume to criticize the great Oz? You ungrateful creatures, think yourselves lucky that I'm giving you audience tomorrow instead of 20 years from now.
Oh.
The great Oz has spoken.
Oh.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. The great Oz has spoken.
You?
Oh, I am the great and powerful Wizard of Oz.
You are? I don't believe you.
No, I'm afraid it's true. There's no other wizard except me.
You humbug!
Yeah. Yes, it's exactly so. I'm a humbug.
Oh, you're a very bad man.
Oh, no, my dear. I'm a very good man. I'm just a very bad wizard.
Should have had Somewhere Over the Rainbow today. That would have been a good song. So, that's in lieu of a joke this week, by the way, in case you want to. I keep her around because she keeps me humble. I want to share with you that in preparing the talk today on the inner sanctuary and how do we know that it's truly holy. When I sat down to do this, I had a definite direction in mind, as I did when we came up with the talk title for today. But as I was doing more and more research on this, it was really carrying me to a very different area. And so we have a lot to talk about today. We have to talk about sacred ground. We have to talk about holy places. We have to talk about inner sanctums. We have to talk about curtains. And this is the first Sunday of Lent, so we have to talk about Lent. And we also finally have to talk about something that we really do not like to talk about. We have to talk about crucifixion. And in unity, because our general approach is very upbeat and positive, we really don't know what to do with this thing referenced in the scriptures, the crucifixion. And so it's very difficult for us to approach this. But if we really want to keep a true Lent, as outlined by our co-founder, Charles Fillmore, we can't just focus strictly on Easter, which is metaphysically the culmination of the whole Lenten process. We have to deal with the various steps along the way. And so we really have to approach this in hopefully some meaningful way for you today. But before we get going, we have to back up a couple of weeks. 2 weeks ago, I gave a talk based upon our second principle, which is our own very essence is of God, and therefore we are inherently good. And in that talk, I made a statement that we mouth it, but we really don't believe it. And quite frankly, I was a bit surprised that nobody challenged me on that after I gave that talk. And so I will ask you now the question that I didn't ask then that I wanted to ask, and that is, how many of you regard yourselves as holy? How many of you Well, we're going to get to that. How many of you regard yourselves as saintly? How many of you regard yourselves as really incredibly divinely precious? And I'm not talking about, oh, every once in a while or occasionally. I'm talking about all of the time. And I'm not talking about, well, yeah, part of me or part of you. I'm talking about all of you inside and out. It's a tough question. And yet this is absolutely positively, you know, one of the most significant cornerstones of unity. So let me take you down a path here a little bit, and I'll ask you to envision yourself as something else for yourself, and that is, think back to a time in your life when you experienced something that you would regard as truly sacred or truly holy. If you work at it a little bit, each and every one of us has had these experiences. You wouldn't be in this room if you didn't. Okay? And maybe it was something like giving birth to a child, or maybe it was something like, for you men, witnessing the birth of your child. You know, and maybe it was a rainbow in the sky after a rainfall. Maybe it was something so simple like a flower, or hearing a baby cry, or watching a puppy play. Maybe it was your first kiss. Maybe it was the exhilaration that you felt in that first sip of coffee in the morning. And the earmark of it, so you could tell if you're on key or not for what I'm trying to get at and what I'm talking about, it was a life changer for you. You may have long forgotten that incident and moved on, but having had the experience, it was much more than an experience. It was something that put you into communion with the reality of God. And from that point forward, even if it was marginally, a little itsy bitsy teeny weeny bit, you were no longer the same person that you were before you had that experience. I'll share with you a few of mine. Many years ago, when I was a young man in the business world, out on a sales trip, and I was going to solve all the puzzles and rule the kingdom. And I took a business trip that took me to central Pennsylvania, and I had an opportunity. I stayed overnight in the town of Gettysburg. And when I first got to the town, I just pulled up and parked my car, and there, less than 100 feet away, was the battlefield where the Battle of Gettysburg was fought. And there was a sign there that identified that, and I went up to there, and I just stood by the fence, and I overlooked this vast expanse of field. This was a site where, a little over 100 years prior to my visit there, there was the most significant battle of our Civil War. And the realization set in that thousands and thousands of Confederate and Union soldiers had died on that grounds, and their blood had spilled into the soil of those grounds. There were over 50,000 casualties that took place over a three-day period. And the enormity of it and the immenseness of it hit me, and I really felt that what happened here was so holy, so sacred, I had no business being there. It was absolutely incredible. So let's ratchet it down quite a bit. I remember when I was a teenager and I had an older brother, and we were always at odds with one another, and I could never take him on physically because he would just pound me. So I used the best weapon that I had, which was my big mouth and my tongue. And one day I said something to him, trying to get at him, and I didn't attack him. I attacked the woman that he was dating. Because And then he had a reaction. And instead of coming over to me and beating the living garbage out of me, he just looked at me and he said, "I'm telling you now, you don't ever want to do this. I'm telling you right now, you are never to say anything bad about Mary." This was the woman that he went on to get engaged to and marry. And I would not have had the language to explain it in the terms that I'm doing today, but what I really had at that time was a realization that I had touched upon something holy and sacred. And I was infringing upon someplace where, again, I really had no right to be. And the last one that I will share with you is, I remember when I was a boy, my mother and my father dragged me along to the cemetery to visit the grave of my grandmother. And I was a boy of probably about, 10 years old. And I wasn't running wild all over the grounds, but I wasn't being careful. And all of a sudden, my mother admonished me like she almost never admonished me. "You need to watch what you're doing. You were walking on people's graves. You know, these people have died, and they are entitled to the respect, you know, which would keep you from walking on them. Walk around them and pay attention to what you're doing." And again, it wasn't an experience that I had, but it was a witness to the reality that secret places, holy places, really, really do exist. And I tell you these stories, I share these with you to try to make a point. And that is, as much as we might search for the sacred and the holy, it is available to us 24/7, absolutely every place we go, everything that we do. And the only thing that prevents us from witnessing it, from experiencing it, from internalizing it, are the barriers that we have constructed in cooperation with what the world tells us to be and what the world tells us to do. It's an inner set of blinders, or a curtain, if you will, that prevents us from recognizing the reality of God on a much deeper introspective level. There are all kinds of references in the scriptures to sacred and holy places. You know, when God calls forth Moses to commission him to go to Egypt and get about the business of setting his people free, God appears as a burning bush. And the first thing that Moses is told is, "Remove your sandals, for you are standing on sacred holy ground." And then in the character of Jacob, he ascends Mount Horeb and puts his head on a stone, and he goes to sleep, and he has a dream about a ladder that extends from earth into the heavens with angels scurrying back and forth. This is a whole other sermon, by the way. And when he wakes up, he realizes, and he issues a proclamation that surely this is a special place. Surely God is in this place. And to acknowledge it, he digs out some oil from his bag and he anoints the stone in which he had put his head while he was sleeping and consecrates this as a sacred place. And then in the Christian scriptures, the classic example is Mary, who is pregnant with Jesus, and she goes to visit her cousin Elizabeth, who is also with child carrying John the Baptist. And as they approach and they greet each other in joy, Elizabeth says she could feel the baby in her womb leap in recognition of what the deepest reality is that is going on at the time. And then we come to the temple at the time that Jesus was around. The temple was the single most significant physical aspect of Jewish life at that time. Jews, not just from Jerusalem in the immediate area, but from all over the world, would travel to the temple to worship and to pray and to be with their God. And then significantly, on the west end of the temple, there was a special section. And that was the section where there was the Holy of Holies. It was a section that was quadrant off. It was a section that was separated by a curtain. And not just any curtain. It was a curtain that was 60 feet high and 30 feet wide and 4 inches thick. And the key word in what I've been talking about right now is that this curtain separated the people from this section where the Holy of Holies was, where the Ark of the Covenant was, the symbol of the covenant between God and his chosen people. And the only person who ever was able to gain access to that holy sacred area was the high priest, who went in once a year on Yom Kippur, on the Day of Atonement, to offer sacrifice in prayer. For everybody else, it was, "You're not welcome." They might as well have put a sign on the curtain, "Chosen, Schmozen, keep out." Because you are separate and you are apart from God. This is where the crucifixion comes in. Because if you read the Synoptic Gospels, particularly the Gospel of Mark, and you read the text, that at the very moment of Jesus' death, he gives up his spirit, or in some translations, he gives up his ghost. And what happens at that time is the whole entire world grows dark, and the curtain in the temple is torn from top to bottom. And all of a sudden, the Holy of Holies, that special place, is there for everybody to witness and to see, and the separation is gone. A couple of lines, a couple of verses before that final verse in which Jesus actually dies, the last words that he would ever speak before his death, in that final hour, in fact, in those final moments, were, and they actually put the Aramaic verse in, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which translates out to, my God, why did you forsake me?" You have to think about this. What does this really mean? And think about it in context of the total picture of who this person of Jesus was throughout all of the Gospels. This was the Jesus that walked on water. This was Jesus that calmed the wind. This was Jesus, the miracle worker. This was the Jesus who healed the sick, and on a couple of occasions actually brought dead people back to life. This was the Jesus that was so confident that he took on both the political and the religious establishments of his day. This is the Jesus that told us, "We have nothing to worry about." This was the Jesus that had a special relationship with the Father and told all of us that we were going to be taken care of, just like the birds in the sky and the lilies of the field. But in his final moment, he offers up a cry of anguish. My God, why have you forsaken me? It's important for us to understand that really, that notwithstanding everything, that there was an experience that eventually would eliminate any and all lines or boundaries or curtains between his humanity and his divinity. But he got there by uttering a frustration and a feeling of total isolation, desolation, and abandonment by his God. All of us, some of us more dramatically, maybe more profoundly than others, have been in that place at one time or another. All of us have suffered pain. All of us have suffered loss. All of us, whether it was triggered by the loss of a loved one, a terminal diagnosis, or whatever, all of us had that feeling, at least in part, of being left alone and abandoned and dangling in the wind. And everything that we thought that we were and everything that we thought that we had, the reality of it came crashing through. But the significance of this, let me back up. I'll share with you openly. I might have shared this with you before. I have had such an experience, what some people call the dark night of the soul. It happened to me when I was at seminary and I attended a retreat. And I can't tell you what triggered it. But all of a sudden, I was in the most pain that I was ever in my life. There were not enough blankets in the world to warm me back up because the cold that I was experiencing was coming from deep within my own heart and deep within my own body. And absolutely everything that I ever dreamed of and hoped for and wanted and prayed for in my life absolutely went out the window and it meant nothing. And I felt fear like I never felt it before. But the significance of the crucifixion in experiencing that desolation and that pain, and then by virtue of giving ourselves up to God completely and totally, that is precisely when the curtain gets torn. And that is precisely when you are most equipped to step forward and embrace the reality of God finally and completely. And that is what ultimately ends up allowing for there to be an Easter and a resurrection and a renewal and a new vitality in your life. When you're in the throes of something like this, what does the world tell you? You'll be all right. You shouldn't feel the way you feel, which is absolutely the dumbest thing we could ever say to somebody because people feel the way they feel. Take an aspirin. Why don't you try distracting yourself? Why don't you go to a movie, have something to eat, watch television, have a drink. Numb it, dull it. Make it go away, but for God's sakes, don't embrace it. Do anything other than that. Many, many years ago, I saw a James Cagney movie, and James Cagney was the gangster, you know. And he was a real tough guy. He killed a lot of people, and he had risen to the role of a folk hero among young people, teenagers, in the Bronx. And he finally was caught, and he was tried, and he was convicted, and he was sentenced to death. And in a very touching scene in the movie, a priest who was a schoolmate of his when they were young boys comes to visit him the day before he is scheduled to die, and he said, "I need to ask you to do something. I need you to be afraid." And James Cagney's character said, "Forget about it, Father. I'm not afraid of anything. I don't care." And the priest said, "I know that. I understand that. But it's important for the lives for those teenage boys who regard you as a hero for you not to go out as a hero to them." And James Cagney says, "Nope, sorry, I can't do it." And then in the next day, in a really powerful scene, as they start to walk him to the electric chair, he starts screaming and crying like a little girl. "I don't want to die. I'm afraid. I'm afraid." In what was the ultimate giving up of his persona, it was, in fact, his crucifixion, that he didn't have to go out in this folk hero person that the world was viewing, or many of the kids were viewing him at, and he left to those kids an incredible gift, because the kids read in the newspaper the next day how he died screaming and yelling and crying, how he died a coward. In the opening clip that we looked at today from The Wizard of Oz, in the scene that when the curtain finally is pulled away and exposed, and all of a sudden there was the realization that the wizard wasn't such a wizard after all. It was a promise that the world had been given to them, that the wizard is going to take care of everything. And the people that were involved, Dorothy and her three companions, were hit with the realization that all of the hopes and dreams that they really wanted were going to be found where? Something that they already had, something that was already in their hearts, something that was already in their core, and it took the removal of the curtain in order for them to come to that realization and have those dreams become a reality. The message this morning is not for you to tear down the curtains, because God is just always anxious to do that. The message for you today is quit putting the damn curtains up to begin with. Quit putting barriers between yourself and your God. And to the extent that you're able to do this, you really will move closer and closer, not to believing, but to knowing that you are the Christ, that the Christ is your very essence. You are that still small voice that you listen to in the silence. You are a sacred inner sanctum. You are the Holy of Holies. And all that prevents you from seeing it is clinging to whatever false notions or unimportant notions that you want to hang onto for yourself, or that the world tells you is so important. It's a subscription to participate in that crucifixion. It's a subscription to dare to maybe expose yourself to some really difficult things in your life, and quit pretending that they're not real, and quit pretending that you don't feel them. And yes, to the point of embracing them, because you come to the realization that in the letting go of that, you finally are ready to rise again and be the very best possible Christ that you could be.